Hi, this is Rob Watson and this is a Decentered podcast. It's Friday the 21st of September and today I'm talking over Skype with Lucinda Guy, who is the chair of the Community Media Association. And what's your role at Sound Art Radio?
It's artistic director.
And what does that involve?
I don't know, everything. Lots of bits and pieces, really. Training people, planning projects, making radio, sometimes things like, you know, painting a wall or rearranging some bookcases, being welcoming to people, that kind of thing. And yeah, kind of overseeing community projects, outreach projects.
So it's a kind of, it's a very hands-on kind of experience.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in that?
So, I mean, my background before doing radio was mainly in music. I did a lot of community music, so lots of singing with tambourines, that type of thing. And then also other community arts, things like making stuff with people. And I got this sort of feeling of the, you know, how liberating that was. For example, if you sit with a big bunch of people and you've got loads of recycled materials and everybody can make anything they want out of it and create puppets and costumes and, you know, things that they can keep and look after. And it occurred to me that working with digital media was very similar. It can be very abundant, just like using free and cheap art materials are, and you can make all kinds of things and experiment and play and share stuff. And to sort of bring some of that arts practice that happens in community sort of making and the freedom of that actually into sort of regulated, licensed media kind of excited me.
So what was it about that? What was exciting about that? Because that's the challenge, isn't it? To take something that you'd previously done in one media and one set of experiences and then put it into something which I presume you didn't come with any radio experience?
Not really, no. I mean, I suppose I've always liked radio and I was a musician, you know, so I'm used to sort of the idea of time-based sound, organising sound on sort of on a timeline. It's the same between music and radio. I think I saw that, strangely, in broadcast media, people can be quite precious, or it can be quite elitist or exclusive, and there's no real need for that. It's just kind of come out of a culture of that kind of media, and that things were just starting to kind of crack apart, you know, sort of once the community radio licensing came in this country, there was starting to be more open and interesting approaches.
And the kind of, so this was a reaction against, if you like, mainstream media, which is very formulaic and tramlines kind of approach, where you stick to the pattern and the format and the kind of, you know, the style, if you like. And community radio gave an opportunity to open that up into a more creative space.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you know, it can be quite fashionable for people to talk about the importance of allowing each other to fail or to try things out or things not to be polished or successful in all kinds of areas of our lives. But we must include the media that we publish in that, because otherwise those, it's fine to say to everybody, oh yes, it's fine to fail, but keep it behind scenes, you know, keep that part of yourself locked away. I don't really agree with it. I think it's, you know, you've got, if you're going to fail, you've got to fail in public so that you can reassure others it's fine to fail. So to make media that's messy or flawed or full of holes is actually a really important part of our sort of creative and cultural lives.
It's funny, isn't it, that software developers can, you know, with apps, that, you know, the methodology for developing apps is fail often, fail early, you know, and you do lots of iterations of things. So you do one version and then it doesn't work and you get feedback from people and you do another version and you gradually build up the, you know, the slickness, if you like, of the capability of the app. But with media, you're right, it kind of tends to be this either or approach. Either it's incredibly well professionally presented or it doesn't exist at all.
And you know, if we're getting too slick, if we reach that point where we've been through that failure phase of and now we're slick and polished, then we're probably not pushing ourselves anymore. You know, if you're finding that it's slick and perfect and you know everything, then you need to try you know, we need to try new things and push ourselves a bit harder.
So this learning process then, you obviously, it's a journey that you've been on. You know, what's that been like for you? As, you know, how long have you now been, how long Sound Art been running, and how long have you been, you know, what have you learnt on that journey?
Well, we've been on air about 12 years. Yeah, I mean, I suppose in terms of what I've learned, there's lots of sort of deeply personal and small things that I've learned around my own relationship with a broadcast studio and a microphone, things like that. And there's kind of wider things I've learned about, I suppose, how to take a project to fruition from idea, you know, and how to evaluate a project and how to grow and work with partners and that kind of thing. So there's learning on all kind of micro and macro levels, really.
And what would you, you know, if you could give yourself some advice from where you were maybe 12 years ago, what would you say to yourself? Would you say, don't do this, or, you know?
No, I think it'd be good to reassure my earlier self that it was going to survive, we were going to keep going, because there's times when you can feel overwhelmed or at risk or whatever, and knowing that it's going to last because, and, you know, it's lasted because we've stuck at it and not because it's been easy, but it would be good to have been able to see that clearly and then maybe not take too seriously the problems or the criticisms or the worries, because, you know, I mean, I suppose in life what we always really want is to be able to float above that stuff and be bigger than it, but it's not always easy to be, so to sort of that you know, that this is a sort of established thing now, and it's we didn't give up.
So what are the elements that kind of keep you driving it forward, in terms of where do you continue to get your joy from? To an expression I'm not very comfortable with using. I don't have the language framework for expressing some of these things. I come from quite a kind of a background in terms of research and ideas, which is quite formulaic in many ways. And when you start to use phrases like, you know, what do you love about radio? Where do you find your joy and your bliss and those kind of things? I get quite embarrassed when I'm using it, but it's a good term, I think.
I really like the word joy. It has sort of very spiritual connotations, I think, that word. I think we, for all of us at Sound Art, there's just loads of things we want to do that we haven't had time to do yet. And there's constant new ideas. And because we're the way we are as a team, which is a very supportive and cooperative sort of team, we're always bouncing off each other with lots of new ideas, and we get excited by them. And also, I mean, most of those ideas are not driven by sort of finance, you know, they're driven by passion, and some of them earn money and some of them don't, and we sort of get by. And so that's what keeps it exciting, is that we're constantly thinking, well, let's do this and let's do that, and being kind of more and more ambitious and wanting to take more risk as we go on and involve more people. So yeah, that's what drives it, really, are these kind of, I think the studio as a space sort of enables us as well to have those creative conversations, and hopefully enables others who come in to bounce off each other and have creative conversations, whether they're about developing ideas in radio or other things in their community.
You've obviously been doing this, you know, you're quite experienced at this now, and you've been through it a couple of times. How do you find when you meet somebody and you bring somebody into the studio who's new to this, and their expectations of radio maybe are, you know, a bit more, you know, like mainstream traditional forms of radio? How you know, and yes, they've made the step forward to want to learn about something alternative, something different, because they're with you. How do you find that process of, one, reminding yourself of where you've come from, but also how you would guide somebody on that journey to think about things in a different, you know, slightly different way?
Yeah. Well, I think we start from trust and from taking each person seriously. So if people, it's interesting when new people come in, some people are absolutely like enamored with it straight away. They just come into space, they just go, oh, yes, you know, and others, can be a little bit confused especially if they've done radio elsewhere. Our main thing is that each person's sort of valued for whatever they're bringing to it. So, and trust, I you know, we really believe really strongly that everybody's really fascinating, that the people aren't boring, and they're all really, really interesting, and they get more interesting as they get more confident, more relaxed in the space to try their own thing. So some people's programs, when they start with us, might be in the style of other radio they've heard, and that's totally fine. And then as they relax and get into it, more of their authentic self, their other radio self that's in there, starts to merge, and these sort of stronger personalities come through because they feel more safe to do that. And that might take years or it might take weeks. I mean, some people come in with a really bold, distinctive idea from the beginning, but sometimes those ideas change anyway once they're there. So, everybody's very different, but everybody's
it sounds,
if they're there, then they're bringing the right thing.
It's remarkable. It sounds almost like a therapeutic kind of approach that you've identified, which is to kind of recognize that everybody's got a story. That they, most people have some level of confidence. Not many people have no confidence in order to be able to articulate some kind of a personal story. And then that trust that builds up over time about being able to be more vocal in that story, that sounds quite like on a personal level is actually quite empowering for people.
I don't know if we think of it as therapeutic, but we think of it as not harmful, I suppose. You know, I think so many of our interactions can be quite harmful when we come into a new space and we're not feeling welcome there, or we're not feeling part of the in crowd, or we feel that our ideas aren't good enough or whatever like that. So it's really trying to remove a lot of that actually quite harmful stuff that's quite common in our society and a lot of our interactions.
So what do you think the kind of broader social impact of the work that you do has had in terms of not just the volunteers that have participated in the station? That's usually the priority, isn't it? But also with the listeners, with people who tune into the station?
Yeah, so we see those people as part of a community together. So the people who come in to present, the people on the board, the people who take part in the show, the people who tune in are a sort of community of the radio. And I mean, I think one thing for us is that we had this strange thing that the week that we were launching, we had that the college we were based at was going to close. I mean, sort of officially kind of merged with a bigger university, but, in people's minds it was an ending, which kind of unfolded after that over several years, so until it finally kind of left in 2010. So at that time there was a lot of fear in the town of what would happen to the culture of the area, because the college as a very distinctive and kind of significant though small performance college brought a very kind of cultural brought a lot of cultural kind of richness to the town of Totnes and the wider area. So there were lots of students moving in and out. Lots of local people had been at the college or would grow up in the area and then go there. And then lots of visiting artists would come from all over the world, that kind of thing. So we were part of, I suppose, not letting the town kind of get too despairing about about that really significant ending, and keeping a sense of sort of handmade culture alive in the town and of experimental or risk-taking.
Is that something that's unique to, Totnes and Devon? Is that something that's in the water there, or is that something that's in your experience is something that is a general?
Both. I mean, I think the important thing about grassroots culture is that there's an awful lot of it happening. It tends to get its significance can be downplayed a little bit. So you'll find that when people speak about arts and culture and the places where that happens and where ideas come from, they'll sometimes sort of fetishize. Sort of cultural hubs of the past. People will go on and on about sort of Warhol or something, and they'll picture this community of artists gathering in a sort of rough space, making new things, making arts and media and trying things out, being in each other's little films, and they'll imagine that. And actually that's just the common way in which arts happens. I think that's similar spaces to that are happening all over the country all the time, tend to be underfunded, undersupported, or kind of dismissed, as I'm sure that community was in its own time, as being sort of inappropriate or sort of indulgent or messy or difficult. Yeah, but we need those very messy, difficult spaces, because that's actually where the work and the ideas are coming from. So I think I see community radio in the context of that as it's building these little places where people can connect and be creative and try out ideas, really. So it's not just radio, it's kind of arts generally, wherever you get a kind of collective of people who've said, oh, let's get together and do this. You know, historically, a few of those groups we've attached enormous significance to and called them the whatevers. You know, there was this movement set up in this city by these people, and really idealised those. But actually, it's just a normal process.
I always like the phrase that Brian Eno, I don't know him, I'm not name dropping, but he uses about, you know, for every significant genius, you know, an Andy Warhol or Picasso or something like that, what they were based upon was a scene. And he said, what you really know, so hundreds of other artists and creative people and writers and bar managers, you know, you can't have these things without the person running the right cafe or the right bar or something like that. And he says, what you actually need is a sense of senius, which is that kind of ability to navigate and know your way around and be part of a scene. And I suppose a culture, rather than just, we have a tendency, because we look at culture through the rearview mirror, of just seeing, if you like, the significant figures that pop up in the past that have been rightly, you know, kind of lionized and promoted, but actually what they emerge from is a broader scene. You know, it's not just them working in isolation. The unique genius model, if you like, is kind of quite deceptive.
Yeah, it's nonsense, really. Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I think that's what it's about. Well, it's about having a scene, a local scene, so people feel proud of where they live. They feel they can be part of that, and it's open. It's easy to see how to be part of it, and where people, through meeting and chatting in those places, and it doesn't really matter whether we're talking about on air or off air conversations here, but they exchange ideas and music and hear each other's stuff and start to work together on things, and just trusting that process, trusting that if people are coming through the door, that's what they're going to do, because actually everybody is fascinating and everybody is creative. It's about valuing everybody's sort of artistic right.
So what's different then about radio and audio? I mean, I kind of radio is more than just speech based and music based, you know, platform. It includes a broad range of sounds, but there's something about the listening process that radio strips away the visual, you know, the when I say the visualization, there's a mental visualization, but there's not an external visualization, is there? You're not looking at something, you're not seeing the spectacle, or you're not seeing an image in front of you. You're imagining something. You're the conversation, you know, very much like this as a conversation, is kind of, there's no reference points to external things. It's just ideas. How do you think people respond to that in terms of, you know, running a radio station? That must be very difficult to manage people's expectations about. Have I floored you?
Yeah, I think your question seemed to change at the last.
Oh, time. I was trying to think about it. I was trying to think, how do
going
I put
along
this
a sudden
in
path, and then it's like, and how do we do this in terms of managing a radio station? Managing people's expectations of visual culture.
Well, the difference between, if you like, a kind of, one of the things I'm thinking a lot about at the moment is the difference between, if you like, an extrovert culture. Western culture is very extroverted. It's very much about, you look at things, television, cinema, everything's about seeing things, and your kind of events are all about going to it, and people put their phones up and watch the spectacle on the stage, that kind of thing. Whereas radio, to some extent, and I'm particularly kind of interested in the idea of kind of podcasting, is actually a very, you know, they call it the headphones generation. It's something where people listen very intently, and it's an inner world, it's an inner experience. And I just, you know, kind of, I'm just not sure I know what questions to ask about that.
No, this is talked a lot about in things like sonic arts and contemporary music, this sort of idea of the dominant sense, you know, being vision, and what are worlds like where we allow our ears to lead us more. But I think there are many ways to listen to radio. I think in recent years, this sense of this sort of well crafted radio or podcast that you listen to more intimately on headphones is definitely become much more of a thing, but I don't think it's the only way. There can be radio to listen to in all kinds of ways, you know, obviously while you're doing other things is a common one, and you know, while you're washing up or driving, that kind of thing. So it doesn't have to be about that. And maybe there's more to explore around collective listening as well, listening radio that's designed for lots of people to hear at the same time, or you know, there's lots of ways in which we can approach that listening thing. In terms of, I mean, there's other things that are important about this, you know, the nature of radio without visuals is partly that it makes people feel very safe to do it, because they're not seen by an audience, they're not judged on their appearance, and I think that could be really important for a lot of people. It's not to be seen, and it can allow them to really shine and stuff to come through. They can take, you know, be bolder about who they are when they're not being judged on their appearance. So that has a big effect as well. Well, yeah, I don't know. What else?
I suppose we do have, you know, a tradition that we've not really... I know this is some work that you're going to do in the future, is an oral culture of, say, storytelling. You know, we as I suppose that's what I mean, it's one of those things that people say, you know, the things that define us as being human. But the orality of storytelling is one of our basic, things that we do as humans. It's just what we do. We love telling stories. We get together and we listen to stories, and as children we like that kind of impulse to, it's like a basic drive to, you know, we find the world meaningful through stories.
Yeah, and that hasn't gone away. I think, you know, people gather, don't they, in places where they can tell each other stories, and some of those are online communities, but some of them are like shops or pubs and things like that. Are still very important, and again, that the radio station, I convoluted several words together. A radio station could be an extension of those types of spaces, because people meet at a station and exchange, like I was saying earlier, culturally, but also kind of community information, both on air and off air. So what they're actually broadcasting is just very similar to those conversations that happen informally in community spaces, because it's a similar type of space. Go on.
Just describe the setup of your studio, because I think for anybody listening to this, a common expectation of what radio studios are like is that they're kind of like a recording, you know, a high-end professional recording studio, which is something like, you know, on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise with lots of buttons and computers. What's your studios like?
Yeah, I think it's more informal than that. I think people need to feel ownership of the space they're in and free to kind of, you know, put a poster on the wall or alter the space in little ways as they come and go from it. So our studio, well, we've got a kind of larger room, like a kind of loungy workshopy room, and then the radio studio itself kind of in the corner of that with a glass wall, but often the doors open between the two. So it's quite informal, and we're quite into radio with the doors open, with the windows open. We've had things like animals come in and, you know, in people's shows, and so it's quite comfortable in that sense. And then when you're broadcasting, you're sitting at a big wooden table that's like a kitchen table with the broadcast desk on that. So it's using stuff that's familiar from other parts of people's lives, I suppose, like a kitchen table or chairs that we've covered in nice fabric. And at the moment, we've just redone the walls in there, and they're all covered in fabric, like purple fabric with cakes all over.
I was about to mention that, because I'd seen that on Instagram.
It was really cheap fabric. I wanted something nice and thick to improve the sound quality in the studio, and I found this very, very cheap, very strange fabric. It's dark purple with illustrations of cakes and puddings all over it, but some of them are wrong. It's quite funny. It's got as though they're done by someone who didn't know much about cakes. So it can be a little bit distracting, because it's got images and text all over it, but it's also kind of quite welcoming, I think, and it does it really nice in there. It's not kind of scruffy or anything, but and it has improved the sound since we kind of did the walls in there. I think the thing for us has always been about using very quite cheap and very simple equipment. We don't have a digital desk. We've never been able to afford one. And we don't use playout software. We just use like a media player on a computer that you can make playlists of shows on. And then people bring in their own media on their laptop or phone or, you know, a guitar, a guest, that kind of thing. And we have record decks as well. And I do think actually in community radio, record decks are quite an asset because they do attract a lot of volunteers, that people can bring their records and play the records at the studio, you know. So things that help people feel welcome. Yeah, and we can do shows from our bigger space as well and sit around on the sofas, and we've got a little balcony and views out over the valley. So it's kind of a really lovely space for radio studio. And I do think what you can see through the windows does affect what you say on air and how you treat each other and that kind of thing. It all seeps in. So talking earlier about visual and oral culture, you know, what we can see when we're broadcasting affects how we speak, even if we're not talking about those things specifically.
So it doesn't break away from the setting that it's in. And maybe that's an interesting area to look at in terms of how does the setting of radio stations impact on the style of programming. Yeah. I once visited Capital FM in London, which is really kind of it's in Leicester Square, so it's very exciting to be in Leicester Square, but inside the building it's really like a bunker of all the different I think the different stations, Classic FM or wherever it was that they've got through the building, were, you know, very kind of self-contained and kind of, you know, you're going through swipe cards and you're going through, and there is a real, and maybe that's appropriate for central London, but it does have a kind of feeling of exclusion, if you like, from it's not integrated into the free flow of the community. It's separate from the community in physical terms, and that does that come across in the kind of programming that they produce as well? I don't know. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always thought it's massively important, like studio design is massively important in terms of programming, but it'd be an interesting thing to try and research, and I don't know how one would even begin to measure the impact of the colours and feel of a space on what's said and how that stuff is said. It's such subtle things sometimes, like your tone of voice or, you know, or where you allow your imagination to go, things like that are actually very hard to measure.
Yeah, and having a if you like an instrumental methodology for measuring imagination sounds to me like a contradiction in terms. Somebody's going to sit down and say, well, we need to design a metric that can measure people's imagination, because I mean, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? Your kind of joy and happiness, you can't think yourself happy. You suddenly find yourself happy or sad. You know, I like the phrase that Carl Jung says about emotions. We don't have emotions. Emotions have us. And it's that kind of sense of, you do something where you forget to measure something, but you feel happy. You know, once you stop trying to measure something, that's when you open yourself up to feeling, the joy comes through, maybe. So you can't answer it in a direct way, I suppose.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, this relates to something I've been thinking about when we talk about things like social impact. Is I think something I realise is projects that I'm distrustful of, I suppose, are about changing people rather than changing circumstances. And I mean, I really, really believe in, changing circumstances, not in trying to change a person. So, for example, if you've got a project and it's saying, oh, you know, for the people who use this project, they'll become more confident, or they'll start to fit in better, or they'll be more skilled for employment. Rather than saying we're going to give people access to culture or access to safe and comfortable spaces or more money or better housing, things like that. Do you know what I mean? I think I'm kind of worried by this sort of sense of changing the person rather than changing the circumstances they're in. I think something I really believe in is trusting the person to be whoever they are and do what they want to do, and being okay with that. And actually, that gives them a new circumstances in which to just express what they're trying to say, rather than that be kind of criticized or condemned or seen as sort of wrong. You know, I think certainly in terms of making culture and music and things like that, it don't have to make nice or pleasant or easygoing stuff.
Because what we end up doing is we end up looking at, if you like, the people always say, well, how do you measure the outcomes of a project? And you know, people want to see something demonstrable. What does you've changed somebody, and therefore you should see them doing something different? I said, well, we're not in the business of changing people. People will change anyway, and people will change and react to circumstances both positively and negatively. And I suppose the question is, you flip it round the other way and you say, the traits of behaviour, how are they stopping people? What are the barriers? What are people being prevented from doing things that they would naturally want to do if they have the freedom of choice and the confidence to be able to do things, rather than trying to drive people through a kind of, you know, a sausage factory approach, isn't it? You know, it's kind of our education system is now geared around this kind of approach about personal development. And most of the time it's just about letting people be to do the things that they enjoy in the range of circumstances that might be available to them. And it's about improving the range of circumstances rather than changing the people. Yeah.
So those things that suit who we actually are as people, if we want to be a very quiet and introverted person, and we need to be someone who, you know, doesn't cope with sitting through a lecture or a class or needs to keep moving all the time or whatever, those are perfectly fine ways to be in a sort of well
adjusted society. Yeah,
it's totally fine to be a child who needs to run around all the time, and they're probably going to have a much healthier heart and bones and everything for life if they run around and fidget all the time.
I tend to find I do some of my best thinking when I go out for a run or a walk. And you look at classical philosophers, you know, and Beethoven composed while he was out walking. The idea of sitting at a desk, you know, we've got the modern culture as this sterile culture of, it's like a work ethic that you've got to be seen to be working and sitting at a desk and somehow absorbing this information as if you're a machine. You know, that your process, when you think of, people are often described almost like being computers. And it's not the case at all. It's completely different than that.
So. Sure, yeah. And this sort of wanting to be able to say to each other, oh, I've been so busy, I answered 1,000 emails, or I did that, you know, and it doesn't always get very much done, does it? You can be busy doing nothing quite a lot of the time.
I do try to justify myself these days on the amount of nothing that I can do, which comes quite easy to me at the moment. So is this kind of approach sustainable?
Well, it's financially sustainable.
Well, I mean, what level should we think about sustainability for this? Or in what ways?
Well, there's that thing, isn't there, about different types of sustainability. So is something environmentally sustainable? Is it economically sustainable? Is it socially sustainable? I mean, I think the more communities control their own information, the more sustainable they are as communities. Economically, I mean, almost anything. This is the funny thing, I think, economically, in terms of running community projects, almost any model you can come up with is you can build any kind of funding model into. I mean, there's going to be something out there that will pay for your work, however you approach it. So it's just finding the right income strands to match your own values and belief and your approach. And there, you know, we do live in actually quite an abundant, despite all its problems, we are in quite an abundant time and place financially, even though we don't feel that, we can feel pressured. Really, on a global scale, we're quite lucky to be where we are. So something I'm quite interested in is, I've used this tool called the Business Model Canvas, which is quite a popular tool for business planning, where you just put everything on one page in front of you and see the relationships between the different areas of your work. And I really believe in this sort of social enterprise idea of having quite a mixed business model. So not trying to think, oh, we should be grant funded or we should be commercially funded or anything, but looking at, you know, who wants to pay for the different things you believe in and the different things that you do. So just loud sneezing going on in the background here.
Sound effects.
So, I just pressed a button. Something we're doing at the moment is we've just registered with Ofsted to provide children's activities, which means that basically we can charge what those cost to run, and families who come can claim the cost back on through their tax credit system. You know, so there's funding models out there from not coming from media, but coming from other parts of society that we can learn from. And the reason we've done this is because we want to have more children's voices on the radio, more children making programs. We're very interested in what they have to say and how they approach that, and not teaching them to approach it the way adults do, but actually learning from them what they bring to radio. So that excites us creatively, and there's a funding model we can use to facilitate that. You know, so it's really about, like, whatever it is people want to achieve or believe in, not compromising those beliefs, but seeing where do they match economically. There'd be something.
And what's the best way then to share and kind of disseminate this kind of, I really don't like the term good practice, because I think we should share bad practice more. It's more important to share bad practice than it is to share good practice sometimes. But how should we disseminate and share so that we can learn from each other more broadly?
Do you mean other community media groups can learn from each other?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Oh gosh, I mean, I suppose things like doing these kind of podcasts is a starting point. I mean, it's not the answer, but it's a step along the way. I think looking at the, you know, kind of how we, we have the advantage now of being able to use social media and being able to pick and choose our streams of content and information, and being able to divide them up between, it's almost like you can put them into categories, I suppose. So you can do professional, mainstream, commercially funded broadcast media, and then you can do what we might think of as traditional forms of community media. Then you can organize streams about, you know, kind of artistic, creative, innovative media. We've got a little bit more, but that, I suppose, takes needs some guidance, and I suppose some curation, if you like, from people who are sitting down and putting some thought into it. So my background, I suppose, in kind of academic terms is about what is that kind of framework that you can understand these things in. But then what you find in practice is that, you know, and it, you have to get rid of the inherited framework and continually go out and talk to people and be with people and learn from people about what they're doing, because it continually changes all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit wary of an approach to information sharing that separates us all more rather than brings us more together. So I think we need to visit each other more. I think people need to be in one another's spaces. I think that's something we should all look at, how we can facilitate better. There's some good kind of models of this. I mean, hang on a minute, I'm just going to find it, tell you what it's properly called. There's a thing called the community media,
you do know I don't edit any of this, so whatever you say or do, it just stays in.
That's
here.
Fine. Yeah.
Unless you libel somebody, so
it's the Community Radio Continuous Improvement Toolkit.
Right.
And this is published by University of Hyderabad. Is that how they pronounce the name? And where the UNESCO chair of community media is based.
Right.
And it's a toolkit that's been used all around the world. And basically the idea is that radio stations can sort of buddy up and help each other to evaluate and assess their work through kind of, I think it's worth people looking into. You could include a link.
I was fortunate to go to Ghana a few weeks ago and to visit a community radio station in Ho, which is in the Volta region. And the kind of the level of resources that they've got is, you know, comparable, you know, very, very basic, I suppose. However, the recognition of the role that radio still continues to play in the region is very important, because the kind of access to data services is not, that's great, it comes up on Skype with the link, that's amazing. So
I just sent it to you.
I know,
yeah.
It's fantastic, technology is great. It's but the but, you know, you, so radio still play, you know, we kind of almost in the UK, in the West, we've got this kind of attitude about technology is that we dismiss the basic simple ideas and precepts of radio, because we think, oh, well, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's legacy stuff. It's not relevant to the new world. It's not relevant to future lives, that kind of thing, which is all going to be data driven. But actually, when you go to a place which has got very little infrastructure and resources, radio still plays a massive role in people's lives because of its simplicity, its cost effectiveness, and its openness to be able to, you know, it doesn't have the costs that television has, and it can be much more portable and engaging with people and build relationships.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the thing is, we mustn't dismiss that importance here, just because a lot, you know, there's an awful lot of people who are online when they're at the library, or you know, when they're in a position to be, if they're a library member at all. There's an awful lot of people, I suppose, left behind by this sort of digital world, because I think we tend to keep talking about, there's a sort of cycle where the people we're talking about the most are the people who are seen as economically contributing the most, and that other people's lives, you know, don't really matter very much. No, so I think there's an awful lot of people. And basically, we need a wide range of technologies, and we need to keep those, the skills and those technologies alive in our communities for quite a lot of different reasons, partly because of the lack of control over, you know, analog broadcasting. It's not, it's very private. It's very empowering in that sense compared to what's happening with our data and our personal information online.
So just to wrap things up, what do you think, what do you return to as your, you know, what's the types of media or creative engagement that you return to in order to, like, if you like, recharge your batteries?
For myself. Yeah. I mean, I do still really like to make radio and to edit, to record and edit sound, and also to do live. I do thing where I do live improvisations in the radio studio, and I use the equipment that's there to make sort of patterns and loops and things, not bring in other equipment or other devices. So if you, in your studio, if you just play your own web stream back into your broadcast desk, you get a nice delay of a few seconds, and you can play with that and make patterns and create fun stuff out of it. So I still do that kind of live improvisation with sound and stuff like that. And so still do my own kind of creative radio practice where and when I can, and through that process I've learnt quite a lot about what's really going on with things like a broadcast desk and a microphone and a, you know, in some ways you have to kind of abuse these technologies to really understand them and push, you know, push them a little bit to find out what else they can do, to really learn about how they work.
So if anybody wants to find out more about what SoundArt does and what you do, where would they go?
So our website, soundartradio.org.uk, and I mean, you can just go on the website and explore. There's a lot of different content on there about our projects and programs, and things cross through with a variety of tags and things. So go on there and just do a search for the types of things you're interested in. If you're interested in radio art, or if you're interested in community media or whatever, you can just search under those terms, and lots of different related projects and programs and things will come up.
And have you got any events coming up that you think people might be interested in?
Well, we are now launching our children's radio club in the autumn half term, which is really exciting because we had to wait till we got our certificate from Ofsted in the post, and that's all in place now. So this is quite exciting. So that's coming up. What else is coming up for us? Oh, I don't know, all sorts. Yeah.
Well, let's talk again in a few weeks, and you can tell us what you learned from the Children's Radio Club, the experiment of that. So
yeah, there should be some really fun stuff to listen to. We tend to do things like making up stories together in the studio, or, you know, quite kind of fun, interesting things, and then they come up with ideas of programs they want to do, and we facilitate that where we can.
Cool. Okay. So if anybody wants to get in touch with me, this is going to be via the Decentred website, so it's decentred.co.uk. If you're looking for the, I mean, obviously you found the podcast because it's on iTunes, look for Decentred Media, and on Twitter it's Decentred Media as well. But Linda, Linda. Why did I say Linda then? What was that about? I conflated your name, Lucinda. That's what I did.
I get that quite a lot. Yeah, I also get called Belinda sometimes.
Sorry.
And I think people should join us on the CMA chat, chat.comedia.org.uk, to sort of discuss these topics and others, or pick up information about funds and projects and all kinds of things on there as well.
And it's a great place where we can share our experience, and I will post the link to this podcast up on the CMA chat forum as well, so which you can put onto your phone. I forgot to mention this at the CMA conference on last Saturday. I forgot to actually mention, apparently, that yes, it is available as an app on a phone. So for iPhone and for Android, look for the Discourse app, and then just go to chat.comedia.org.uk. Is that good?
Okay. I think you did say that. I think you did.
Cool.
All right.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you.